Yeah.
Okay, it's the 19th of July. We're talking to John Llewellyn and near Montgomery Grove, near Ukiah, California. And he was just remarking that after he published his article on the reluctant counterinsurgents, it was all over, you know. No more visits to Harper's Ferry as a guest speaker. he just lost all that kind of clout, influence, and opportunity. But we'll be starting this interview in just a minute. Daughter got a train on a train in Saigon.
She got on a train in Saigon, and she was picked up by a couple of guys, and they took her to a wedding, and she just had a great time in Vietnam. She took the train right up to Hanoi. Mm-hmm. She went out and saw Ho Chi Minh's embalmed body. And it was just like a tourist trip for her. You know? And that was so amazing to me because my last memory of Vietnam is 69. Mm-hmm. You know, and I felt like I was just barely getting out alive. And I couldn't move around without taking airplanes and helicopter flights. And when I got there, I'd usually have a effete little Swedish K submachine gun on the seat beside me or wherever I went, just in case I was jumped by somebody who wanted to kill me. And it was just a
Swedish K being a preferred gun of the unconventional warfare specialist.
Yeah, the counterinsurgency's
yes.
favorite little
toy.
Yeah, yes. Right. And so there I was, you know, like an IDS volunteer with this thing, this Swedish K.
Well, not too many IDSers carried weapons, so that in itself is a treat.
In fact, when Richard Peters went to Laos to investigate the Poor Area program, he found an IDSer sleeping with a Thompson submachine gun. And he said, no, you know, we're not going to do that. That's not what we're here for.
I won one in a poker game.
Still happen?
No.
Tough to bring those things back.
I left it there.
Yeah.
Actually, because of the inflation rate when I was there, we couldn't live on that pittance of piastres that the IDS was giving us, me and my buddy. So I would play a lot of poker, and I was a net winner. I'd win. And that was how we kept ourselves going economically. By
See,
playing
guys,
poker.
This is what you get. You know?
Dad was a star.
Dad was a poker player. Actually, my grandmother.
Good
kept,
role model.
Exactly. No, my grandmother kept during the Depression. My grandmother just played poker and supported the whole family.
Yeah.
Well, just for the fun of it, John, what year were you born?
1942.
And where were you born?
New Mexico.
Any place in particular?
Albuquerque? Yeah.
And some IVSers live there now. Did you grow up there? You know?
No. No. I never grew up.
Yeah, well, did you physically mature there?
No, but I'm a kind of a West Coast person. I was raised in a little town on the peninsula in the Bay Area. And then we moved to Salt Lake
Brisbane.
City. Brisbane. California. And then we moved my dad was a government accountant.
Yeah, that's my next question.
And we moved to Salt Lake City, but he wasn't too keen with the Mormons. He didn't go along, so they gave him a choice of Alaska or Guam. And we'd been reading Jack London instead of
Robert Louis Stevenson.
So, frozen north.
Well, but Jack London was a Californian, you know? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I graduated from Juneau High School.
Uh-huh.
And then...
What was your family's religious background?
Fundamentalist Christian.
Fundamental of any particular stripe?
Disciples of Christ.
Disciples of Christ.
Yeah. Yeah, Lyndon Johnson, Jim Jones, and me are all Disciples of Christ.
Yes, these connections, of course. You know.
Right? Yeah.
And, by the way, the voices in the background are... State your names, guys. Go ahead. Shanti and...
Lauren.
And they're going to offer occasional laughter and tears as we go along now. So have a good time.
Yeah,
so,
these are my sons.
Yes.
They're both born here in Mendocino County.
A great place to raise your kids. Right?
Yeah.
Yes. Shanti's looking at me like, you don't know the amount of cocaine in my high school. That's right. But anyway, you don't want to know. Yes. You don't need to know.
No, need.
This is a need to know basis.
Need to know interview.
Yes, exactly. Right. Right. Yes, because if we knew that, we'd have to kill you. I'd like to tell you, but did you go to college after Juneau High School? Did you know?
I went to Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington.
Whitman was a religious school, wasn't it?
Well, it was.
Yeah.
By the time I got there, it was a liberal arts college, kind of uptight liberal arts college, which it still is.
What was it? What affiliation, though, was it before?
Presbyterian.
Presbyterian, right.
Marcus Whitman it's named after.
Right. Yeah, another IBSer went there, too. What did you major in?
Political science.
Political science, just like your daughter.
Well, they're no longer trying to make it a science, and I'm really glad about that. That's one of the reasons I bailed out. They were trying to
Yes. And they still are.
She graduated in politics. Right. I graduated in political science.
Right. Yes, in England it's just called history and politics, not political science.
Yeah, they were doing all this foamy. Anyway, and I was pretty...
No milk for me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was in the old days when I lived in England, I put stuff in it.
Okay, I hit it with honey, though.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay, good.
Raised by local bees, I hope.
Oh, it's just full of shit.
Nan, there's a huge shortage of native bees in the United States, and they're having to breed them and ship them all over the country? Nothing's being pollinated.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because the native bees have been worked out by the spread of lots of stuff and bad weather. Mm-hmm. And it happens regularly, that is.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event,
some might be a little bit sour.
Did you wash them?
No, they're full of shit.
And they have all that
shit.
Stuff on it.
Yeah.
Fly stuff. And
so I graduated from Whitman '64, and instead of going right to law school, I took a Fulbright grant to India. Mm-hmm. So I was a Fulbright tutor in English for a year at the University of Rajasthan in Jaipur. And then when I got back I started out at Stanford Law School.
What led you from being an English teacher into law?
I was really a flaco English teacher over there. It was just a scam to get to India. But I did do a village study there. I lived in a little village and I studied economic, political, social development. I did a bunch of surveys and stuff. I was still kind of like reading out this whole political science thing. I had the idea that Americans could go around and bring democracy and prosperity to the world. This was an idea that was in my head at that time.
Missionary stuff.
Right. Yeah, it was kind of like the missionary thing carried over to, political, economic, social development thing.
You want to blame that on John F. Kennedy? Was that?
Well, the Peace Corps was starting. I think that this psychology was there, that I was part of this, and I believed this. And India started to kind of work it out of me, that kind of thing. It had a big influence on me in that I just couldn't stand going to school anymore when I got back here. So I finished a year at Stanford Law School, and I dropped out. And they were just going to coddle me right through the thing, and I would have been a lawyer if I'd have just been able to... didn't even have to go to class, you know. I mean, my friends would show me notes and stuff, but I just didn't want to do that for a life. And at that time, the Haight-Ashbury was heating up, and so was Vietnam. And I just wanted to be in life. And I got fascinated with the idea of going to Vietnam. I was also fascinated with counterinsurgency warfare. I was going from being a true believer in the American destiny to reform the world into realizing that we had this military-industrial complex that was trashing the world. I mean, but I was still way in that space where I thought that counterinsurgency warfare might be a good thing, but I was beginning to suspect that maybe there was something else going on.
And so in other words, there are good guys and bad guys in the world, and you're beginning to think that maybe there was something not necessarily all good about what America was doing in the world, but you believe that there were bad guys trying to make that good happen, and that counterinsurgency had a chance to create a space for that good thing to happen?
Yeah, well, let's say I was just confused, and I wanted to really see what was going on, mm-hmm. and I was actually attracted to the excitement of the war mm-hmm. and of the place. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be there. I mean, there were a lot of my peers who didn't want to be there, mm-hmm. big time, you know.
But
I wanted to be there.
But you could sign up. Free tickets going, you know, after a certain amount of basic training and advanced infantry training, there was a free ride.
I've never been attracted to being under orders from anybody at all, mm-hmm. ever. Mm-hmm. Plus, I have physical ailments, you know, where even the USAID program rejected me. I tried to go over as an AID volunteer mm-hmm. or employee. So I couldn't have got in the Army if I wanted to, which I didn't.
Because of your kidney?
Yeah, one kidney. Yeah, they didn't want to be stuck with a lifetime of liability payments.
Did you look for it? And,
no, we no. got the family got hungry last night, and something had to be eaten. Yeah,
and, for breakfast. Yeah, right. At least civilized, yeah. and they ate kidneys yeah. and eggs for breakfast.
The factual quality of this interview is just kind of like, you know.
Yes, exactly. but imagine the student that gets to transcribe it. This is the best part. And I always throw that in on the tapes to make them realize that they're not forgotten.
But yeah, the whole thing that led me to the IVS was that I dropped out of law school and I showed up at this USAID recruiting thing, mm-hmm. and this guy recruited me for USAID. It was 66, mm-hmm. and they were just hiring all kinds of people to pour them over into Vietnam. But they didn't hire me because of a missing kidney. But the dude who I interviewed with liked me. Mm-hmm. And so he got me a job back in D.C. with Human Sciences Research Incorporated.
I know those guys. Yeah?
Yeah, it's kind of like...
It's a think tank.
Yeah, it's kind of like a spook front think tank.
It's a spook front.
Yeah, they do a lot of ARPA work. Yep. So I got back there, and I was the wrong guy for them. See, because
why is that?
Well, I just didn't know it was a spook, think tank, and I was just sort of like, "Oh, what do you know?" You know, and they were, "Oh, get this guy out of here, terminate."
Well, did it happen when you said, "Hey, I don't want to do this stuff," and they said, "Well, then we don't want you," or
I just wasn't fitting in. Basically, the guy who liked me had split by the time I got there, uh-huh. and then the guys who were there, they had their own guys, mm-hmm. So pretty quick, they said, "Well, you ought to go back and get an advanced degree as of such and such a day," you know, kind of thing. And so then I was still looking to get to Vietnam. So I heard about this IVS, you know. As soon as I found IVS, like within 2 or 3 weeks, I was in Saigon. I mean, you know, like they were not at all that discriminating about who they were, you know.
Well, they were more than you think, but in 66, they had a large introductory program that they set up eventually. But.
So I was there real quick. Uh-huh. And then they sent us to Nha Trang mm-hmm. for training.
That's Nhatrang.
Yeah.
That's for the...
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nha Trang.
Just not pronounce that. Uh-huh.
Just a beautiful coastal... town, an old French colony. It was just being overrun by American troops, but just body temperature, oceans and everything. And yeah, there's this guy, Jim Lin was our trainer.
Wasn't he killed later?
Somebody told me he's dead.
Yeah.
That's right, I was going to ask you about that. That's kind of a weird thing to ask about somebody, you know. But anyway, I think he died.
He was killed in a plane crash in Laos or something.
Something happened to him where he's no longer among us, I think.
Well.
But at that time, he's kind of like a farm boy kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And he was really into rubbing our noses into the poverty of the peasants kind of thing. And so he was trying to get us used to eating like one bowl of bulgur wheat a day for breakfast and this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. the refugee wheat that was distributed by the, and to really get down there with the peasantry. And
but the peasants weren't eating the Bulgur wheat much, were they?
Oh, you got to be kidding,
yes,
man.
I just wanted to they get
would,
that out of record.
Yeah, the Montagnards would make tapai out of it. And the, you'd see, which was a fermented brew, you know, you just stick a straw in it. It was pretty sour. And they'd greet me with, Manyum tapai! And so you'd sit down and drink this stuff with them. Yeah, they'd brew some stuff with it. And it had various uses, all of which weren't, you know, somebody actually eating it, you know. Like the refugee chiefs would steal it and probably sell it to the guys who were raising hogs and stuff like that. But Jim Lynn, he was feeding it to us. Well, the results was that within a few weeks, the volunteers who were coming in were 4 instead of 8, you know. And then another result was that I immediately learned that the IVS was going to try to finish me off, you know, and so I would just have to figure some other way to make it. So we, well, my thing was I threw in, me and my friend threw in with, there was a Canadian attaché there, you know, and so we just befriended the guy, you know. And so he had a nice liquor cabinet and lots of food and all this kind of thing. And so we just, we'd figure out how to work around this pittance that the IVS was kind of throwing to us and get around this whole thing. So 4 of us kind of found a way to stay around the whole IVS trip. And then after, 6 or 8 weeks of that, then we were stationed, myself and one other fellow, we were sent to Binh Tuan province. Mm-hmm. And
spell it for the tent.
Binhtuan. And then we got down there, and then there was this old guy who was the USAID province representative named Chet Richardson, and he was running the place, and he liked us, and he kind of fit us into his program. Mm-hmm. And he looked at the scene there, and there were these Montagnard refugees who'd been living in the hills there, but the U.S. government had gone and drawn lines on the map making free fire zones. That is anything moving, man, woman, child, water buffalo, chicken, anything, could be killed on site in that zone. And that happened to be their towns, you know, that was where they lived. And so they had to move onto some really barren land outside of a Nung Chinese village named Song Mao, Songmao.
And Nung, N-U-N-G.
Yeah, Nung, yeah. And there they were, and they were just in a world of genocide, really. They would just try to kind of like sneak back onto their land and do whatever they did, a little bit of slash and burning agriculture, mm-hmm. cutting bamboo, or making. Well, I finally set up a crossbow industry where they would make crossbows, and I'd sell them to the GIs. Was one of the things I did.
Did they actually use crossbows in their regular lives?
They did. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So mm-hmm. they were making knockoffs of their traditional weapon for the for GI souvenirs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did a beautiful job. But the colonel's commanding that I'd sell most of them up at the Phan Thiet Airport, Phanthiet. That was the province capital of Binh Tuan. I'd put these crossbows on a helicopter and go up there and sell them. But he finally just told me I couldn't sell them to the troops anymore because they were killing each other with them. They would think they were toys. They had these little, they looked like little toys. They'd have these little teeny bamboo bolts, you know, and you'd pull the thing back and you'd get a little bit drunk and you'd shoot it at your buddy and it'd go right through him, you know. I mean, it was just...
I hope there isn't anybody on the wall with,
you know, that. So he said, no way, you can't sell these to my troops anymore. They were beautiful hardwood crossbows.
Backtracking a little, when you were assigned, to the province, and you arrived, and the local USAID guy said, "Hey, I got something for you to do."
Yeah.
What was it?
See if you can help these people out. Go up there and do anything you can for them.
Because they're refugees.
Yeah, I was a community development volunteer. And then I had a friend of mine, he was with me, but I'm not going to talk too much about him other than he's still one of my closest friends.
Who is he?
Rick Swigert.
Where does he live now?
He's in D.C.
Okay. Just obviously if Paul has him on his list.
Yeah, he told me about you guys, but he didn't want to talk to you.
Oh, well, that's too bad. You'll call him and tell him that it's perfectly harmless, that we have no agendas and we just want to hear everybody's story. And
that isn't it. He just doesn't feel right about talking about his experience like that. He just doesn't feel like doing it.
I used to feel that way about certain things, and I never realized how important it was actually to talk about. So.
Yeah, I'm the other way around. I just wrap off him.
Yeah, that's cool.
Mile a minute, but yeah, but Swigert, he just doesn't want to talk about it.
Well, if he's expressed that opinion, he's on a list of people who said that. There are about 10. We're not going to approach them at all. So he's that's fine. So
but,
you.
But he and I were pals, and we stayed together for the whole 2 year tour, from the middle of '67 to the middle of '69. We were in, out, around, and under Song Mao. That's where we were.
So you were sent up to the Montagnards Yards and try to do something for them. You looked around, you figured they needed something for income. Or sustenance or something.
Have you ever read Henderson the Reindeer?
Sure. Oh,
yeah, that's the best description.
I thought you were called the King of the Rade.
Yeah, they called me Patau Raglai, the King of the Raglai. Yeah.
People spell that, the Patau.
Yeah, well, it's Cham. That's actually what I learned over there. I didn't learn Vietnamese. I learned Cham. And I don't know how you'd spell Patau. You can spell it any way you want.
No, go ahead, just spell it.
I'd call it P-I-T-A-U, then Raglai, R-A-G-L-A-I. It's actually a Malayo-Polynesian language. It's like Aranglai, you know. I learned how to count in their language, and then I could understand, like, the Indonesian number system. The Cham used to have a big empire there in South Vietnam, and they were overrun over the centuries by the Vietnamese. But there's still quite a few villages of them left. And then the upland Cham are called the Raglai. And so these people I was working with were the Raglai.
And that's C-H-A-M.
Yeah.
So you learned, how did you learn Cham?
Yeah, I learned Raglai.
You learned Raglai.
Hage Soni. That means, what is that? So you get the nouns that way. And I knew a little bit of French, a little bit of Vietnamese, and that's how I learned Raglai.
Did you get any Vietnamese language training when you first arrived?
I did, but I blew it. You know, some of my comrades had gotten fluent in Vietnamese, but I wasn't one of them. I just didn't, I'm not that good at that tonal trip, you know, like.
That the Raglai is
no,
a tonal.
No, no.
And by the way, in Hindi, it's yek yak hai. Yek yak hai. Well, you know that. Yeah, so you can hear the rhythm. And one of the things you did once you got up there was this crossbow program. Is there something else that you did?
Yeah, well, I became kind of more and more drunken and cynical as time went on. When we got there in '67...
What month? Do you remember what month you got there in '67?
Yeah, it was about June.
June of '67.
Okay. Yeah. Then there was kind of like... there was a feeling of advancing on the Viet Cong, the National Liberation Front, a feeling... actually, my first night there, I was just plunged right into the war. I mean, just my first ice-cold night.
What happened?
There were about 8 or 10 Americans stationed there in a MACV
compound.
And the major walks in and he says, "Well, we're going to be attacked by about 1,000 troops tonight, you know." And so I was with, my buddy I was with, he was doing alternate service as a Quaker, you know. And he says, well, my religion forbids me to bear arms, you know. And then they looked at me and I said, show me how to use a machine gun. And so this old boozy sergeant, he says, you know, he took me into the bunker and he gave me a steel pot and he says, pull back twice and shoot low, you know. And so that was the night that I learned how to transport myself to another place temporarily. I just went to Hawaii. I wasn't even there for the night. And what I learned over the weeks was that the village spies, they were only paid when they sent in reports of troop movements. So almost every day they were reporting, you know, like companies and divisions and battalions attacking. And so it was just a big scam because as long as they weren't reporting anything, they weren't getting paid, you know. And so it was also good for the Viet Cong because it was like crying wolf, you know. You never really knew when they were coming because they were always coming en masse, you know. And so, but that, it took me a little while. By the end of the 2-year period, myself and my friend Rick, we had been there longer than any other American had been there, you know. Like somebody said about Vietnam, we don't have, 20 years experience here. We have 1 year experience 20 times. And that was really very obvious to me. And I just got, the only thing I can't explain to anybody, and least of all myself, is why I stayed. Why did I just stay there for 2 years? It just became my world. Now, the whole thing about my work, my job, became more and more surrealistic and absurd as time went on. Well, first I tried to live in town, live with the people like an IVS volunteer and disassociate myself from the military and for the government and all that. But it was real obvious that as an American, I was just identified with the military invasion, mm-hmm. particularly at night. Mm-hmm. And well, I rented this place and then somebody set up a machine gun emplacement some night right next to my house and opened up. There's no war movie that will ever let you know how it feels to be next to a machine gun. There's no way except for to actually be there. It's just everything quivered. I had a lot of diseases when I went to Vietnam that were due to anxiety, and they left me almost immediately. I was just cured. I had nothing but fear, and it was really healthy.
Oh, real healthy.
Yeah.
Well, there was nothing left for the other fears.
Yeah. Well, there's a big difference between fear and anxiety. There is, you know. Right. You get colitis from anxiety, from fear, just everything jiggles and you shit, man. I mean, you know, so. It was real good for my health. So, they were actually shooting up the police station that was across the street. But it startled the hell out of me, you know. And so pretty soon, over time, well, actually, we ended up living in that town because it was a Hnung Chinese town. But I spent a lot of time in the compound with the bunker guys at night. In the day, they'd set up the perimeters, and they'd clear the roads, and we could move around with a modicum of probably not being shot at. But at night, everybody would kind of close up and fold out to bunker kind of mode, and hunker down and hope that they were attacking somewhere else that night.
Now this was a MACV compound, right? It wasn't a provincial headquarters with U.S. advisors, but a MACV compound.
Right. We had the MACV compound, which was an old French scene there. Mm-hmm. We had province capitals going down through the valley. Mm-hmm. The Cham province capital was, I spent a lot of time living in the room with the district chief, mm-hmm. quite a bit of time, because we liked to get drunk together, mm-hmm. and he thought I was a real amusing guy, and he thought I was somebody who had to be really watched closely, mm-hmm. and so he wanted me right in a room with him.
Well,
so,
is that because he assumed you were CIA?
Or? Right, Yeah, because nobody could figure out why. You know, the whole IVS story just didn't hold water at all.
No, never did.
They all assumed that I was working for somebody, but the agency knew I wasn't working for them. And so even they were wondering, see? And so as time went on, I would play on this, you know, in order to gain, you know, a certain advantage in social relations and whatnot. Perhaps you don't know who I'm working for, kind of thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And
did you ever interpret your IBS card where it just says IBS? That's all it said. Did you ever, you know, say something like, well, that stands for Internal Vietnam Security or something like
no,
that?
No, I never...
Never had to go that far.
No, I never did that trip, but it was just too blatantly obvious that I was there to watch everybody. And so they were all kind of, you know, like,
Did the MACV advisors feel that way towards you? Did they?
Well, see, I went through several majors, you know. Mm-hmm. Our little outpost was a repository for majors who were not going up, you know. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, like backwater majors, is the guys who came out to our place. And they were the commanders, and then they'd have a few sergeants and stuff under.
Oh, by the way, the MACV is M. It's capital letters MACV.
Mm-hmm. MAC-V, mm-hmm. Military Assistance Command Vietnam. Yeah. And so I want to. I guess you know I was supposed to be doing this thing with the Rog Lai, and in fact I did a lot. You know, I tried things. Now there was one guy. Well, anyway, yeah. What I would try to. Book-length manuscript, which is my memoirs of these days.
Oh, great.
It keeps getting lost around here. But
yeah,
I think
Mom replaced it somewhere.
We tore apart the whole house the other day, and Lauren finally found it in the last corner of the last closet, and now it's gone again. But
I think Mom stashed it somewhere.
If you want, I'll buzz a copy off
great.
And send it to you, because great. I like readers, you know.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I do. I mean, I'm a manuscript editor for a bunch of...
And it actually runs down my 2 years from the point of view of how I was thinking about it. Right after I came back, I was actually trying to debrief myself because I was nuts, you know. I mean, it's actually looking back on it. When you look at the veterans who committed suicide or whatever, they just carry a lot of stuff around, you know. For me, it was very helpful to express it, get it out.
And your mom tracked it up, didn't she?
My mother did, yeah. My mother did. Yeah. I would try to do like typical community development projects, like get a school built out there, get some, you know, any kind of a economic base going for the Rog Lai that I could. And it was, everything just got stopped by the whole absurdity of the situation. The war just got more and more intense. Mm-hmm. Tet 68 hit, and then, after that, it was just really crazy. It was just full-on war kind of thing. And I'd go around with a little gun. I'll tell you that I was really lucky in that I never had to shoot at anybody the whole time I was there. And that was just raw luck. I know guys who were like Quaker conscientious objectors who had to kill people, you know. But I would have done it. But I didn't have to.
Who do you know who was a conscientious objector who killed someone?
Don't want to say.
Okay.
If that person wants to say, they can say.
Okay.
Oh.
But you know this for a fact on your own observation, not hearsay or rumor, something like that.
Hearsay, rumor.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
It's, of course, the idea is, well, if they don't say it, then we don't know. But I can talk to Don. I mean, whoever their team leader is probably would say. But I'm interested in the person.
Well, he was really...
I'm interested in the confirmation and... You can't give me a confirmation.
Yeah, good luck. But ask around about that maybe. Yeah. But I don't want to lay. I don't know. I'll lay that much out.
No, I'll give you an idea. There was one volunteer in Laos who rode in airplanes, went on parachute jumps, carried a machine gun. Mm-hmm. You don't have to know his name. The question is, I asked,
do you know this person for a fact did that? I was talking to Galen Beard. And he said, yes, I saw him do it. So, mm-hmm. See, we don't need his name at that point. We know there was one volunteer who did it, and as far as all our study wants to know, is that. But the point is, it's confirmed. It's not a rumor or something like that. So I asked Fred, were there any IBS who you found out later were CIA? And he said, no, that was just a rumor that, you know, they used it as a cover. You're absolutely right. You know, it's just a rumor.
And well, Pop Buell was an IBS volunteer.
Well, he wasn't an IBSer when he was doing the stuff that...
Right. Yeah, you probably, yeah.
Yeah, when he was doing counterinsurgency, he wasn't IBS. Mm-hmm. But the point is that it's, you know, for as a historian, you know, it's like this anal retentive thing.
Yeah.
You know, you have to know, otherwise you end up being a popular historian and your book starts sounding like Rambo. So it doesn't...
Yeah, well, with me, see... Yeah, I can see what you're getting at, but that's always been and always will be the problem with any kind of war memoir, is that it's a different world.
That's right.
The entire thing is different. Mm-hmm. If you get into it, you start referring to, like they called the U.S., the world, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, and then it would just have it has its own rules, like... And that's the basic thing, in a way, all of us who have been there who are trying to communicate anything, we're trying to communicate this to some degree. But there's no way. It can't be done. But we'll keep trying. So, right. On the idea, like...
Where did you get your gun? Or your weapon?
Yeah. Some MacV guy gave it to me. Uh-huh. Yeah, I had a Swedish K. It was a little small. And I just carried it for personal... protection in case somebody was trying to kill me, which I presumably would be the Viet Cong and the National Liberation Front. But in actual fact, I was most nearly, you know, shot at and most nearly killed by friendly fire at night. Because I'd be somewhere and I'd decide to go somewhere else at night and then get shot at. For me, I was really very attached to the idea of being completely independent from the military, not being under their orders, and being on my own. Mm-hmm. And so I loved Don Luce because he would really beat them back like that. They were always trying to, you know, the government was always trying to put in more controls. But in our case, we got so far away from the IVS management that we weren't under anybody's control. Yeah. We were just...
You and Richard.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We were just there, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, they came and they tried to evacuate us after the Tet Offensive, and we wouldn't go. We just... I don't know what it is. To tell you the truth, I was having too much fun. Mm-hmm. I was enjoying it, you know. It was just completely... looking back on it, it was just like a walk on the shadow side of my personality. It's like you're raised over here. You can't drive too fast. You can't drink. Mm-hmm. You can't screw anything that walks. You can't shoot anything that moves. And you have to go to bed early, and you have to have a job, and you have to report to somebody, and so on. And this was a complete blowout on the other side.
Would you describe that with the actual proper use of this term for IBSers as "wee doy"?
What's that?
It just means life of the dust, but IBSers meant, you know, to live life adventurously, you know, not attached, not having anything.
There were different IBSers, and they took different approaches to them. Some of them were very monastic, and you know, like Jim Lynn, and you know, devoted to duty and farm boy kind of guys, and I was doing this other thing. That was what I was doing, you know. And it doesn't make
Henderson
me...
Henderson the Rain King.
Well, yeah, or even, it's just a walk. I could see myself now, it was a walk on the shadow side of the personality. Uh-huh. Although I don't want to paint myself too funky, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not trying to make myself look good, but I'm just trying to tell you what happened.
Yeah.
And if you could have seen the line of American troops in Saigon waiting for a blowjob, you'd see what I mean. Or if you go to Tijuana, this is kind of like where the American male culture goes to have its, you know, big blowout on the shadow side, is some foreign military scene, and Vietnam was great for it. I mean, it was just perfect. It's such a beautiful country, beautiful women, lots of good booze, the food was good, you know. And the war was exciting. And then we were just free, like even the IVS didn't control us, you know. We were just gone, you know. And we got so belligerent, we could just psych out most of the crew chiefs and guys, you know, when we'd see them. For them to inspect us, they'd have to fly from wherever they were at to Saigon, then they'd have to get on an Australian Caribou, which is a troop transport, go to the province capital, then they have to wait around for a day or two for a local helicopter to fly them to Song Mau, because all the roads were all controlled by the Viet Cong.
The name of that town was S-O-N-G...
M-A-O.
M-A-O.
Yeah, right. And so we were just out there, you know. And after the Tet Offensive, they evacuated half, at least half of the IVS team was evacuated after that.
Well, how many people? Oh, half of the IVS team in country.
Yeah.
Yeah. What happened at Song Mau during the Tet Offensive?
It interrupted one of the best parties of my life.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we were just having a grand old time.
Well, it was Tet, you know, so.
Yeah, I know, it was Tet. All the troops were home, and we were just whooping it up. And I had all these friends, and we were drinking and, you know, visiting villages. Oh, come over to my place, come over to my place. And I drove down one morning for the party, and everybody was gone, man. It was just empty. And I saw a couple of Vietnamese women walking along, and I was going to offer them a ride. Usually they'd, you know, jump in and titter a little bit. And
you had
give them a ride.
A scout or something?
I had a 151 Jeep.
Uh-huh.
It was sort of like, there was all this stuff around.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like here where you have to go buy it and it's yours and so on. It was just around, you know, like you say, oh, you need a Jeep. We got one over here and so on. And
snatch.
Yes. It's one of the benefits of a war zone, right? Yeah.
Right, just take it from the enemy.
Whereas in the rear echelon, if you don't sign in for it and return it on time, you're in big trouble.
Yeah. So I stopped to pick up these women, and they just ran away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went down to see my friends, and they were just, they looked like they'd seen a ghost. They said, oh, everybody in Song Mau is dead or captured. See, we were in Song Mau, a little bit inland. Then you go down the river, down the valley a little ways.
Mm-hmm.
You come to Phan Le Cham, which is a Cham headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't like the Vietnamese. As
is it P-H-O-N-G? Or
where are we?
No, Phan Le Cham.
Phan Le Cham. Let's go.
P-H-A-N-L-I-C-H-A-M.
Cham.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the remnants of this old empire.
Right.
And they're thrown in with the Americans to help fight the Vietnamese off of them, to help them kill Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go on down to the coastal villages where I was partying.
Uh-huh.
That's Phan Ri Cua.
Mm-hmm.
P-H-A-N-R-I-C-U-A. It's just a big swarming fishing village,
mm-hmm.
and just full of all kinds of people. And
that's where you were partying.
And
so you got your Jeep to drive back up country.
Well, so I'm living in Song Mau, and I sleep late, right? That's one of the reasons I'm telling you this story.
Right.
I would drink at night and then sleep late, so I'd miss the morning roadblocks and explosions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I would be moving around 10, 11 in the afternoon, they'd have all that stuff cleared out of the way and security in place, and I'm on my way. But I got down there and they said, everybody in Song Mau, which is where I just come from, is dead or captured. You know, the Viet Cong, Boku VC,
mm-hmm.
they've taken over, man. They've taken over. And I said, oh, you know? Well, I must be a ghost. So I went back, and then that was how I found out about the Tet Offensive. The party just cooled. And what had happened is that our outpost, which would have been just a piece of cake to take with the troops that they had moving, was considered so inconsequential that they figured that the Viet Cong figured that they would take the province capital.
Right.
And then just mop us up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sat there with a double shot of something in my hand and listened to William Westmoreland announce that our outpost had been overrun with all people.
Everybody
killed.
Right.
Killed. And we were just sitting there. It was a very ghostly feeling.
Yes, it killed was, in Vietnam and you didn't even know it.
And I didn't die, yeah, right. And so they just skipped the whole thing, you know, but the party was over. So that was my run on the actual offensive. That's what happened to me.
Mm-hmm. What happened to Phong Nha Chau?
Nothing. Mm-hmm. That whole valley there that we were in, mm-hmm. Phan Thiet was a province capital. It's maybe, 40 clicks away? What is that in miles? Not that far.
That, yeah.
40, 60, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, they hit it twice. I happened to be there for the second time, and I think it was about the same. The same kind of scenario both times. That is, the center of town. There's kind of a river that curves down into the ocean. The center of town is kind of on a barbell-shaped isthmus, that has the river here, curving into the ocean. Then there's a bunch of buildings here. So to like get at the headquarters of the military and the Americans and all this, they have to rush the town, go through all these structures, and make it across the river, and then they've got us, right? And so I watched them do it a few weeks later. They figured that Phan Thiet was soft enough, and they had enough left so that even after the first Tet Offensive, they hit again, mm-hmm. while I happened to be in town. So I got to experience this thing, man. And so, first as they came through the houses, they would run the bombers and spooky birds and just bomb out the whole place. But it was when they hit the river that they'd hit it. And they just hosed them all down with spooky birds out on that river.
These are C-47 gunships or
yeah.
C-130s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mostly C-47s. Yeah, it was at night. Uh-huh.
And, how they lighted, how did they make their way along?
Who?
It was at night?
Yeah.
This was happening?
Yeah.
You could run around in the dark with that flashlight.
Oh.
Was it really light or did they have trouble going around? Was it light enough?
The troops.
Yeah.
Flares. And maybe moon. I forget whether it was moonlit or not. I remember I could see there might have been electricity and lamps in the town a little bit, a lot of flares. And those spooky birds were just a big feature of my life the whole time I was there. They would be hosing every evening on the perimeters of wherever I was at. And they'd make a sound like this. It sounds like a big fart. And then out of the sky, you might see the plane or not, would come a circular cone. It would spread out at the bottom to about 100 yards width down at the bottom. You could see it because every X number of bullets is a tracer run. And so it's making a circular field of death about 100 yards wide with 50 caliber bullets coming downward. And that's what saved my ass, was those spooky birds running up and down that river. Otherwise they would have, by the time they were doing that, a lot of the troops that were supposedly defending us had gotten into baskets and stuff and they were headed out to sea. And
baskets and
yeah, whatever. Yeah,
it was like Moses and the bulrushes.
Yeah, it was kind of a fishing town, and they had a lot of whatever they had, you know, boats, baskets. Goodbye. It's kind of like goodbye, Phan Thiet. And but those spooky birds did it. And then I remember talking to like there were the Catholics there. They were all brought by ships in 54 from North Vietnam, you know, and they were just kind of set up in little villages. The priests were kind of like the boss men of the village. And in 54, when the French split, the priestess came and said, well, God went south, so let's go. And so they loaded them on a bunch of American ships and set up these villages. So these priests, I remember they got together with me. They were interested in my political opinions, acutely. They said, look, we saw this happen in 54. It's the same thing as happening here. They're going to run you guys out of here. And we'll be stuck with them down here, you know, the communists. And I said, no, this is a different scene, because as soon as the enemy takes over anything, the American forces will annihilate it from the air, so they can't hold anything. Thus the famous statement, we had to destroy the town in order to save it. That was the whole tactic. If they took the whole town, they'd just bomb out the whole, and spooky bird the whole town, you know.
And killing the good people with it.
Yeah. But they never, you know, the worst attack that I endured in Song Mao, I forgot. I blotted out. I was in shell shock probably until now. Maybe I'm still in shell shock. I certainly didn't know when I was in shell shock, and so maybe I'm still, you know. It was my last night there. They mortared the compound that we were in. And then Swigert told me about it years later. I said, what mortar attack? You know, and he had to tell me what I did and stuff.
What did you do? According to Richard.
Well, I had gotten so, yeah, by the time the second one came down, I'd wake up under the bed. That was kind of like an instinct I had, and then I just kind of crawled. He said he remembered following my skivvy-clad ass into the bunker. And that's what he remembered. I didn't remember anything. It's like shards of memories I have about that. I don't remember it. It's not there. I just kind of like wonder what else I might have blotted out, you know. And it was a lot of my behavior in subsequent years is explained by the idea of, shell shock or whatever. They got a fancy name for it, you know.
Post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
It actually grew, you know. George Carlin did this. It started out as shell shock. And the numbers of letters doubled, it became combat fatigue.
Oh, I see.
And then they doubled the number of words until it became post-traumatic stress disorder. See, as science advances, like political science, it gets larger and larger to describe the same thing.
Yeah.
So what, after Tet, I mean, you know, you weren't killed.
No.
No. And did you go back to Saigon at some point where there was a discussion of what happened with IBS after the post-Tet situation? Or did you stay up there?
The discussion in Saigon! Yeah, sure, man. Like I say, it's another world. It's another world. Mm-hmm. We're these guys from the field and we come tumbling into Saigon. And then there are these guys around the headquarters in Saigon. And it's like looking at an elephant by the blind men, you know? You're getting different angles. So what I got was the guys who had been through the Tet scene in the IVS headquarters, they described actually being run out of the headquarters by military attack. You know, they had actually had to leave under fire. And then the Koreans, who did a lot of the just vicious, dirty work for the Americans in Vietnam, which is a good, juicy expose nobody's really done that I've seen.
Well, a Korean has.
Oh, good.
In a novel called White Badge.
Yeah. Right. Well, they had a compound right next to the IVS headquarters. And the way they'd do, they'd keep expanding, you know. That was how they'd do it. So they were kind of like, And I just remember some wild drunks there. I mean, really. I mean, I remember one where we got up on the deck, the veranda of this old French kind of IVS headquarters. We got raving drunk. We threw all the furniture over the side. And I remember riding a motorcycle through the barracks, you know, through the sleeping quarters. So this is the conference, right?
Yes. Oh no. Anything is good.
Oh yes, we're discussing how to go on with the program.
How do you go on with the program now? And now that you're riding your motorcycle through the dormitories, throwing things over the veranda, not caring what the South Koreans think.
And then Luce was gone, and then there's this real nice guy, and he just kind of hid in his room from us. I mean, you know,
it's kind of,
yeah, right. Yeah, he was real nice. He's, oh, you know. So this is IVS for me. With the Montagnard thing, I went from kind of trying to do village projects with them to just day-to-day survival things. Mm-hmm. Like the U.S. had a great medical system there, so I could go out and get them in it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of their problems, like big tumors and stuff, were, I learned really the value of hydrogen peroxide there. I'd get a, you know, like a medic would go out there and he'd just start pouring hydrogen peroxide over everybody's, just separating wounds and stuff. And they would clear up, man, you know. It was just amazing. Locally, there's this little hype about hydrogen peroxide, maybe it's bad for you or something, but I know where it's coming from with hydrogen peroxide, man. I've seen it bring people back from just, you know, big. A woman who had a big tumor from her lip, I remember, it looked like a big gonad hanging from her lip, and I just put her on a medevac chopper, and these doctors would work on her and so on, and she came back and they took it away from her, you know, she was cured. And so I'd do that kind of thing. And I got cynical about it. I'd be having a couple of drinks, and I'd say, well, should I go out there and save a life today or not? You know, this kind of thing. And then they were supposed to get certain cash compensations and bulgur wheat and rice and stuff. And I would go to the province capital and I would basically get right in the face of all of the Vietnamese refugees officials who might be having other ideas for where this, all this stuff should be going rather than to the Rog Lai. And I'd get them to load it and I'd find sometimes I'd get a Chinook helicopter. I remember I was on a Chinook helicopter with some colonel and he says, do you realize what it's costing to bring this rice to these people, you know? I said, man, get the rice there, you know, this kind of thing. I mean, bringing it with Chinook helicopters. It's just, maybe you're getting a little of the feeling of the absurdity of the whole thing. And then they'd say, well, look, you'll bring them all this stuff. Why don't you, or out at the village where the Rog Lai, look, we need some machine guns and stuff, you know, could you bring us that? And I say, no, I can't do that, you know, like I'm an IVS volunteer. And to them, it's like, you know, it's all part of life. You need money, rice, machine guns. That's what you need, you know. And then I just drifted away from them. I went to a Vietnamese coastal town. I kind of followed along with one of the majors that I liked, and he invited me to come up there, and tried to electrify the place. I tried to copy an electrification scheme that this IVS guy had done in the Mekong Delta. I went down to the Delta, I visited the guy, and I can't remember his name.
Sorry.
And he'd electrified this village. By getting a generator from the property disposal office there outside of Saigon. And so I decided to do the same thing for these people up here. And I just screwed the job up royally. I mean, I just got them this big piece of junk, finally came up there that was pretty useless. But getting it trucked from Saigon and seeing the property disposal office and dealing with Vietnamese truckers was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Just seeing that PDO, Property Disposal Office, was the most awesome thing I've ever seen. They had everything piled by categories, like there was a mountain of shot-up helicopters, another mound of just torn-up, crashed-up, beat-up jeeps, and another mound of armored personnel carriers. They had these category mounds.
Like and tires and stuff, too?
Yeah, tires, right.
A big one, isn't it?
Right, and I was out there looking for... The Seabees were helping me, the Navy Seabees, and they were, they were ordered to come with me, and they didn't want to be there. And I was watching a shirtless GI pushing 55-gallon oil drums into a fire. And then they blew up, and he just spattered him with his shirtless body with this burning oil. And he said, "Oh, mother, oh, mother." And I took him back to medical. And then I drove away from this place, the most wasteland thing I've ever seen. And there are all these, like, entrepreneurs dealing this stuff. You know, they're like, they're trying to buy a mountain of jeeps to ship to Hong Kong or something, you know. Doing a lot of money trips. You know, that whole money trip was big time. And there'd be women doing short tricks and selling beer as you drove out of the compound, you know, just kind of like in the weeds and stuff. Yeah, just kind of a surrealistic, nightmarish scene. And I never did get that project set up over there either, the electrification.
Well, just for the fun of it, to go back to the after Tetton, you went back to Saigon. Did you? By the way, was that party after?
I don't know when it was.
Doesn't matter.
It was after Tet.
It was after.
Oh yeah, because everything got just several degrees of crazier and wilder. There's something about when there's just war everywhere, and people are accustomed to dying, you know, in the evening and stuff. It just changes the vibes a lot, you know.
So were you there when they got the information that David Gittleson had been killed?
I wasn't. Uh-huh. No, that happened. I think I might have been on the plane to Vietnam, and then Don Luce was the chairman, he was the head of the party at that time, and I was just sent out to the field right away. Luce has always been a distant and aloof figure to me.
Huh. Oh, because
even though we worked later in the anti-war movement,
because you went out. And then he left.
Yeah, but right. Even like later, we both got into the anti-war movement, mm-hmm. and I wrote this Ecology of Devastation, mm-hmm. Indochina Penguin book in '72. Mm-hmm. I got a money grant from Stuart Brand to do a convention on ecocidal war in Stockholm, Sweden, mm-hmm. and I financed the flights of Luce, mm-hmm. and Branfman, and several other people over there, and we made quite a little splash.
So actually, you're actually the person who lost the war in Vietnam then?
Yes.
So you know, Fred and Don were described as the two people who lost the war in Vietnam. But of course, they couldn't have done any of that unless you financed it, their trip. So see, there.
Yeah.
Boy, you guys, this is a pretty big moment here with your dad, because, you know, he lost the war in Vietnam officially. You know what I'm talking about, the congressional record? The ambassador to Vietnam said that, you know, and asked why, you know, it wasn't his fault that the Saigon regime collapsed in 1975. It was Fred Branfman and Don Luce.
Right on! Right, right. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. Right, yeah. And I was financing it with Stuart Brand's money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I can go so boast to out like that.
That's right. He lost the war in Vietnam. Because
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. 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 If I didn't know.
IBS lost.